Okay, as much as time will allow, I'll give a little introduction. If we don't have enough time to get to the heart of tonight's discussion, we'll come back to it some other time. At 10 to 7, 5 to 7, depending on how much time we have, we're breaking for 5 minutes, and then we're going to have the official Sichat Musar, which is every Thursday night, again in a rotation. We want to end the week with a little bit of joint Musar. So that's the schedule for Thursday, 6:15 till 6:55 or so is the Rosh Hashiva Chag, 6:55-ish or so till 7:15. Is a Hichat Musar, and then either dinner or Maariv, depending upon when the winter, we're going to have a Maariv at 7:15. Okay. Let me tell you about a story which is very formative in my life. 1985, I return from Gush, and I go to YU. And I enroll in YU September 1985. And I enroll in the Rav Shir. And I enroll in the Rav Shir with an incredible amount of anticipation that I get to study Torah from one of the greatest people in my mind who's lived in the last 200 years. And then January 1986, he retires to Boston because his doctors decide he's too ill to constantly be shuffling in and out hospitals. I was heartbroken. Heartbroken. Here I was. I missed one of the greatest Jewish personalities, not by 20 years or 30 years, but by a year or two. And now we fast forward to 1993. Right before I make Aliyah, Pesach 1993, the Rav was Nifter. And I went to the Levaya. I remember standing on that street in Boston, right near Maimonides, over there carrying the mace away. I remember talking, so to speak, to the Rav in my mind, saying, "You never met me." Even when I was in his shia, it was very hard for him to, he was very aged and infirm. "But I was your last Talmud, and I will be your Talmud." And I consider myself a Talmud of the Rav, having spent a few months in his shia. And not even that, because those are very difficult months, as you can well imagine. How did I become a Talmud of the Rav? Because that's the difference between a Gadol and a Rav. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given me the schus to be a rabbi, teacher for, Baruch Hashem, at this stage, close to 30 years. I've taught many, many Talmidim, Baruch Hashem, and I hope that I've influenced their lives and changed their lives, the lives of their children, their wives, people they come into direct contact with through the Torah that ricochets. I don't have any expectation that I'm going to affect not just the lives of my Talmidim, but of my Talmidim's Talmidim. Marginally, Rebbe, a Talmud of mine, will tell over a story that I told some shot, but a Gadol doesn't just have Talmidim. A Gadol has Talmidei Talmidim. That's who I was. I was a Talmud of the Rav. My Rebbe, Mofak, was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And through him, I didn't just get Rav Aaron's Torah, but I got everything, not everything, but whatever I could of the Rav. And others, when I was in YU, others they came into contact with, Rabbi Schachter and other Rabbanim, but obviously primarily Rabbi Lichtenstein. So I missed the Rav. I lived in the vicinity of the Rav's generation. I missed him by a semester, 2-3 years when he was prime. But I was close enough to still feel his impact rather than just reading about him in some yellow sefer, a yellow book. And I feel like I'm his Talmud. As I mentioned on Shabbos, that's who you are. This is the first group that came to this yeshiva not expecting to come to Rav Lichtenstein yeshiva. Last year's group, when they enrolled or signed the Bar Musil Baruch Hashem. But here's your chance. And this yeshiva was forged close to 50 years ago by two visionaries, great people. You should just know how many people out there, when I travel, and I issue my slate of what I'm going to speak about. Tell us about Rav Aaron, tell us about Rav Amital. Tell us a little bit about who they were. Tell us the stories. Try to capture who they were. You're close to them. You live with them. You work with them. You're their Talmud. And this is your chance. And that's why we feel this is such an important slot. Because we don't just want you to read the Gemaras and Rashis and Tosfos and Rishonim and Tanakh and Halacha. But we want you to be able to get a front row seat in their building with people who spent 20, 30, 40 years with them. Close up and personal, not just hearing their shiur and reading their articles, but eating with them, celebrating bar mitzvahs with them, weddings, being traveling places. That's how you really get to know the true measure of a person, not only through their writing. So that's part of why we feel this is such an important slot, and we take it so seriously. But there's a second agenda, which is related, but just as important. And you're starting to get that feel. This yeshiva has legacy to it. It runs very, very deep. People that come to this building feel that impact not just a year or two after they leave yeshiva. You'll meet people. Many of you have met people that went to this yeshiva, 30, oh my gosh, guy. There's something very, very deep that runs through this yeshiva. The values we speak about, the revolutions that we've created over the last 50 years, the revival of Tanakh learning, settling our land, building a community around the yeshiva, building Hesder, building a model for Hesder. Traditionalist firmkeit, solid, rock-solid, uncompromising commitment to halacha and rabbinic authority, but a progressive view of the world and an engagement with larger national responsibilities. And that's hard to come by in today's world. So people that are part of this yeshiva almost feel like they're part of a movement to a degree. And movements can be dangerous, they can be cultists, they can be exclusionary. We don't want any of that, Chas Hashem. We're part of Am Yisrael. And we feel that commitment and that integration, but there's something special about the ideas that they spun and that they presented, and that they lived and they built. And in some of your minds right now, you're probably asking the following question. Well, this is going to be a bit of a tease this year. Because you're going to tell us about how wonderful it was to spend all those years with the Rav Aaron and Rav Amital and all their Torah and all their perm stories and all the anecdotes. And I cheated from that. And didn't you have... Let me tell you something. You're living their yeshiva. This is 10 times the yeshiva it was when I was here. 10 times, not twice. And you're getting 10 times the experience that we had. And that's the nature of great people, as they launch these new models, and it just takes a generation for those models to blossom and to materialize and mature. So you're getting the mature version of Yeshiva HaRetzion that they built, with their spirit, with their values. Did anyone notice this week how seamlessly everything runs? The trains keep running. You know why it doesn't? Because there's no politics here. It doesn't exist. There's no ego. You sometimes see me and Ellie kidding around. We are like brothers. There's no ego because Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital were such great people. And one thing we saw for 30 years was the way they deferred to each other. Well, I never saw that before. Yeshiva, two Rosh Yeshivas. Anyone that would have an ego or political, you'd be laughed out of the yeshiva. This is Rav Aaron or Rav Amital's yeshiva. How dare you project yourself? Whenever we make a decision, it's only about you. I've never been in a decision in this yeshiva where it's been about the Rebbe. Who should you go to? Well, what does the Rebbe need? It would be a joke. You'd be a laughing stock. That's just one example. So you haven't met Rav Lichtenstein or Rav Amital, but this week and everything you've experienced is all because of what they set in place and the people that they taught and even the synthesis between the Israelis and the Americans that you're feeling. It can't exist. It's simply a once-in-history experiment. You know why it exists? Because where Bryn and I, just picking Israeli Rebbe, we were on the benches of Gush together in 1980. It's not two programs grafted onto each other, where you try to have roommates and sit together for lunch. There's a natural trust. There's a natural symbiosis. Some of the Shanal of Israeli Rebbe were in my shiur in the early 90s. They're my Talmidim. We've got all these relationships because we share common experiences that we, as a staff, we move in sync. We move in lockstep. We live through the same. Rebbe Zak and I. Remember, Rebbe Zak is a Shanal of guy. Made a lot of noise. I always kid him about that. But that's why everything is so integrated here. So I could iterate everything you've experienced this week and tell you how it stems from having lived through these two great people. But I want you to, oh shucks, here I missed Rav Aaron, here I missed Rav Amital. You're getting their product and you're getting their Talmidim. That's why we take this slot so seriously. Okay. Let me see if I'll talk a little bit about the issue I wanted to talk about. Maybe just a teaser. We'll get back to it some other time. It's going to be roughly, 1 week Rav Amital, 1 week Rav Aaron, 1 week Rav Amital, 1 week Rav Aaron. Roughly the way we'll do it. It could be based on who's giving, scheduling constraints, travel itineraries. You'll have 2 weeks of Rav Aaron in a row. Okay? Don't complain. Don't sue us. Don't 2 weeks of Rav Aaron in a row. But I want to talk about Rav Amital. There's so much to say. Rav Amital, when he davened on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, is a legendary davener. He made a lot of mistakes because he davened by heart. He wasn't looking at a machzor. And he swept us off of our feet and captured. There are minyanim across the world that convene just for Yamim Narayim based on Rav Amital's nusach. Eli Weber used to lead a minyan in Tinek that would meet just on Yamim Narayim to daven Rav Amital's nusach. Famous Rav Amital davening. He was very, very deliberate about not repeating any words. Never repeat. Very melodic, beautiful davening. Never repeat any words. One word, he repeated. Entire Yom Yerushalayim Kippur. Slichos. One word. In Zechronos, Rosh Hashanah, at Musaf. So in the introduction, before we actually cite the Psukim, Ashra Isha Lo Yishkacheka. Uven Adam Yisam Etzbach. We moan. You remember everything, Hashem. Ata Zechaz Kol Nishkachos. Uvkud they call Yitzur Mufanach Abba. You see everything. You know everything. Ein Shechal Vek Yisei Kvodecha. You're not forgetting. You see us. You disrobe us. You know us whom we really are. All the conceit, all the fake. All. And then it reaches this hilt. And then you realize how broken you are, that you're the one who forgot Hashem, and you wish you had it, because it's not a good day to remember that you're constantly forgetting the trick. And Rav Talmud launched into this very foreboding melody. Ashrei Yishalo Yishkacheka, ya 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 ya. Everyone would join in, 6, 7, oh ya 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 ya. You'll hear it this year because we still sing his melodies. And there was a pause, and then he shrieked out, Uven Adam Yisam Etzbach. Then we'd all sing. Kidar Shecha Le'olam. He'll learn these tunes. The only word he repeated in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur was Ben Adam. And Rabbi Bazak mentioned this in the Hesped he wrote for Ramital. He thought it was deliberate. Because religion is a tricky thing. Because religion is about. It's about searching for the other, as I said last night. And searching for the other means transcending humanity. Becoming something else, becoming a malach. Talk about this later. Walking away from the transience and the vapid rapidity of this world. Searching for the heavens. Traveling somewhere else. Pushing your limits. Disengaging to a degree from this world. And that's our aspiration. And boy, did we receive that from Reb Lichtenstein. He caught a model for us. Someone that hardly slept. And someone that never said a bad word. And he was... Rav Lichtenstein, you heard about this, you know, the only thing I could say was like the Vilna Gaon. Like he came from a different planet, from a different world, from a different reality. He didn't operate on the same frequency that I ever seen other human beings operate. It was like it was a different species. People had the feeling of Vilna Gaon just plummeted into history. Hashem sent the Vilna Gaon to restart Jewish history, restart the Yeshiva. Like a separate, like an angel, an extraterrestrial being. He didn't live like you and me. He didn't operate. Like we were just in awe. We couldn't make sense of this. Why we tell so many stories? We were all driven to try to capture that paradigm, that example. But Rav Amital reminded us that while we seek to be an Omed Hashem, we have to maintain our humanity. We can't render ourselves inhuman. And you'll hear this a lot, humanity within religion. Hashem doesn't expect us to be angels. He allows us to be human beings. And not only does He allow us to be fallen, He wants us to be human beings. And He wants us to serve Him as human beings. And it sounds cliché. But let me just give you one example, and this is probably just a famous example, and then I'll get back to tonight's conversation. But there's so many examples. Rav Amital once posed the following question to us. And this is a double story. This story has two messages to it. Let's say, I'm sure some of you have studied Rav Amital, have heard this question. Let's say you're stranded on a desert island, and to survive you have a choice between eating chazer, or non-shechted meat, or consuming the flesh of a crash victim. Human flesh. What would you choose? Now let me give you the full information. Human flesh, from a purely halachic standpoint, is less forbidden. There is no isser in the Torah to consume human flesh, to cannibalize. It may be a derabbanan, it's a derabbanan, and it may be a bittul esseh. You may be violating the esseh, but you're not violating the lav. If you eat nevela or chazir, you're violating a lav sheyesh b'malchus. So if you conduct pure, cold, halachic calculus, you should eat human flesh. Rav Amital said, how can you eat human flesh when you have an alternative? Now keep in mind, I want to make sure that the comment is clear. You can never use human sentiment to override halacha. That's unorthodox behavior. Orthodoxy means you submit to halachic will even if you don't understand it. Yamalei syndrome, Parshas Ki Tetzé, the Akedah, which we'll talk about. That's the litmus test of orthodoxy. But in this case, you're already halachically compromised. You have to eat some iser. It's not a question of if, but which. You have to eat an iser. Pikuach nefesh. your hand is compromised.
You have to eat something else.
Do you conduct cold halacha calculus and consume human flesh? Or do you allow human sentiment, which finds cannibalism abhorrent, to influence the decision-making process and to flavor it? Excuse me. To influence it. And Amitel said you should eat pig. Don't ever misinterpret that. Don't ever think that human sentiment can overtell a halacha. But here it can factor into the process because the process is already about compromising halacha. So which I'm not compromising, the prequel that is not compromising, unless you serve it. Now what's so interesting about this story, because it demonstrates how much Rav Amital felt that Hashem created us as human beings and such nobility to human instincts, to human virtue, and an inner human voice, and Hashem wants that to play a role in serving Him, not just to perform mitzvahs and Torah, but to tap into that humanity, to retain that humanity. And that's why the human abhorrence of human flesh can factor into the decision-making process. We right away ran over to Rav Lichtenstein and asked Rebbe, what would you say? And Rav said, I would eat the human flesh. And that was a microcosm of everything that we saw. Rav Aaron, the pure halachist, this angel who was just simply put all human instincts, not to use non-human, but just that service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this uncompromising, immutable, transcendent ties. We're looking at a piece of art. And Rav Amital grounded us. Remember when I first started recruiting for the yeshiva, I wanted to give a sense because they're very much a part of the experience. That Rav Aaron challenged us to soar like angels, and Rav Amital grounded us as humans. And that's why I think he repeated Ravena Dan Misa Mitzbach. Because he wanted to remind us, you're right, in a perfect world, Asher Yishalish Bechecha. In a perfect world, Tazachel Tal Nishkachos, and you arrive in Shoshani, the clean record, and defend your position. But everyone is flawed and failed and broken, and we'll talk about that a lot this year. And I'd like to remind us, it's all right to accept it, and not just to accept it, but to celebrate, because Hashem created a human being, had a heart of purity and virtue, and that has to factor into your avodas Hashem. So let's take a quick look. I'm still deliberating what to do tonight. Maybe we'll just go until we stop. And Elliot was very insistent that I have a separate Musar component, because he wanted to get you regulated to the fact, but because of the room changes and the delay, maybe we'll just go straight till 7:15. But again, keep in mind that next Thursday it's going to be 6:15 to 5 to 7, and then Sichat Musar. I want you guys to learn the schedule, because there's a lot happening. The Akedah is the quintessential moment of submitting your humanity to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. That is the paradigm. There were 7 or 8 classic sichot that Rav Amital would give, and we waited for them with bated breath. He would give a sicha the first day of Elul about entering the yeshiva. We just spoke about it with the girls, have it recorded in Hebrew if you'd like. Migdalot, everything's in Hebrew. Opening night slichot, guys would come from all, alumni would come, and I want you to feel, you'll see alumni, a lot of people coming into this space matter. Today you saw kids coming in, it's a whole team of girls, a whole like high school girls that were coming. This is a place that people come to, not just when you're 17 or 18. People come to this place, to this yeshiva, to this space matter. So you'll see, we're going to have mishmarim, have alumni coming back to learn Thursday nights, and coming back for Shabbos, and coming back. Slichos, you'll see people just wandering in from all over the country. It's exciting to be here, Slichos. They feel like you're not just in the yeshiva, you're part of a community. Quote unquote, a virtual community. So Rav Amital would speak opening night slichos. He would speak the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and the first day of Rosh Hashanah would always be, we used to joke about it, the State of the Union address. The state of Malchus Hashem in this world. Has Malchus Hashem risen or has Malchus Hashem receded this year? Because we are the emissaries and we have to take stock. Where do we stand on the Malchus Hashem scale? And it was never just about whether they learned an extra blot in Lakewood or they didn't that year. In 1991, when communism fell, Rav Amital felt that was a blow on behalf of Malchus Hashem. That an evil regime had been defeated, Malchus Hashem was on the rise. And September 11th, 2001, Malchus Hashem was on the decline. It wasn't the Twin Towers alone that were hijacked. The people, it was an attack on HaKadosh Baruch Hu because Hashem was being presented to the modern world as a God of anger and hatred and terror and vengeance and violence. That's not the God we believe in. Rachamim, Chesed, Shalom. So it's Rosh Hashanah. We're here to be Mamlech Hashem. Where's Hashem? What's the state? What's the state of the union? State of the Malchus Hashem. Second day, he'd speak about the Akedah. That's what we'll talk about today. It says when we read the Akedah. Zachor B'Savos, Akedas Yitzchak, Hayom Barachamim Tizkor. Then he would speak Hanukkah time, because that's when he made Aliyah. He finally arrived in Israel on the third night of Hanukkah from Syria or Turkey. And he saw that as his yearly Sudah Shavuot Hashem, and he talked about Jewish sovereignty and the Zion state and Hanukkah, self-definition. And then, of course, Yom HaTzimut and Yom Yerushalayim. And those were the sikhot that changed our lives. So from time to time, he would speak to us about the Akedah. And Akedah, again, is a quintessential litmus test of orthodoxy. You try to understand. You try to synchronize your will with Hashem's will. You try to decode. You try. But every Jew reaches that point where you can't crack the divine mystery. You don't understand why Hashem wants you to commit genocide. Amalek, you don't understand. I'm obviously going extreme. It'll never happen. We're not in the age of Amalek. But something in your life, a mitzvah, you know. You just submit. I tell it something there itself. You try your hardest to understand. You believe the 99.9999% of it can be reconciled. It all makes sense. But Hashemayim Shemayim Lashem Baruch Hashem V'Leodam. It's a hierarchy of Baruch Hashem. And Shaul fails that test. Mar Yoma says that Shaul gets all pretzeled up about Eglah Rufa, this week's Parsha. Remember, Shaul is commanded to kill all of Amalek. He says, I don't understand. Eglah Rufa, one John Doe dies in the forest. No one knows him. Who dies in the forest? None of you guys. If anyone in this room went missing for 5 hours, there'd be teams of people looking for you. Your family, your friends, your... These are John Doe's, drug addicts, prostitutes, thieves, homeless people. That's the dice in the forest that I count before. You think, put the body in the ground, bury them. But no, it's when you, the value of human life is most threatened, most vulnerable, that we have to reinforce it. Because we'll take life for granted, because it's only a homeless and a prostitute and a drug dealer. No, every human life is valuable, and we have to show all the leaders from all the proximate cities come out and preserve the dignity of human life by engaging in a ritual of burial and confessional that resembles Yom Kippur. So much attention for one John Doe, Shaul says, and you want me to wipe out an entire nation, and women, and children, and animals. So he flinches, and that flinching almost torpedoes Jewish history. Because he spares Agag, who bears Haman, and almost derails Jewish history. If I put a gun in your hand and told you, you can go back to 1920 Austria, meet Adolf Hitler walking down the street, you can pull the trigger. That would be the most moral thing to do, assuming you have that information. You could save the lives of hundreds and millions of people. Hundreds and millions. Again, it's hypothetical. You could be the moral act. Sometimes compassion is cruel. And sometimes swift action is compassion. Very, very seldom, but from time to time. So here's Avram at Har Moriah submitting his will to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hinei. I do what you tell me. I can't understand it. Why would you want me to sacrifice my child? If anything, it's not just my child, but this is morally disgraceful, because I discovered HaKadosh Baruch Hu through understanding moral energy in this world, and interesting him in science. I saw a moral pulse to this world, and I become a moral person, I taught morality, and I want to take that whole system and toss it. And you can imagine the tabloids the next day. Avram the hypocrite, you've been preaching your whole life about morality and ethics, and you take the life of your own son, you murder your own offspring. Because Avram's career that's on the brink, not just the son. He's sacrificing his own accomplishments and his own career. And that's the standard read of the Akedah. But the subtext says something a little different. Practically, Avram submits his choice to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He follows the instructions. He's got the knife and he's about to sacrifice his child. But he doesn't abdicate his humanity. Let's see Avram refusing to relinquish his humanity. Which word? Come on, make believe my name is Rabbi Liebknecht. Source number one. Which word dominates the Akedah story? Kach na es bincha es yichitcha asher hachdash. Des Yitzchak bino. Vayasem al Yitzchak bino. Vayel chushtem yachdav. Avram aviv, vayomer aviv, vayomer bini. Leolab bini, vayakodis Yitzchak bino. Get the point. It'd be very easy for Avram to depersonalize his son because this is a divine mandate and to go into robot mode and say, I've got to divorce all these feelings and love for my child because they may get in the way because I have to act like an angel who has no children, not like a father who feels compassion because Hashem wants me to be that empty, disemboweled, emotionally disemboweled. No, he loves his child. He cares for his child. This is his child, and he will not abdicate his fatherhood, which he feels as a human being. Practically, he submits. He takes that decision. But he maintains that human voice and that human instinct. Rav Amital used to quote the following Gemara. Rashi quotes it. Source number two is Bincha. Avram says, Shnei banim yeshli. What do you mean, Bincha? I have two sons. Es yichidcha. No, the unique son. Both my children are unique, despite what your father told me. Es yichidcha. Asher ahavta. I love them both. What, Avram's playing games with them? You know who I mean. You just dispatched Yishmael. A few psukim ago. Connect the dots, Avram. I was not playing a game with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a chess match. Avram wants a role for Yishmael. If we're making history, I know Yishmael has been discarded. Maybe he can be involved also. We'll find a role for him. Ideologically, theologically, historically, Yishmael may have been discarded, but he's my son also. And if you ask, if you demand this task of me, I'll serve you, but I'm a father. I love him also. Can I carve out a role for him as well? I love him. He's Yachid. He's my Ben. And Hashem says, for whatever reason, on this mountain, on this day, there's only room for one. Yitzchak. But this is a father, not an automaton, not a robot. This is a living, breathing, crying father. Then, of course, at some point, he really cries. This is the famous Medrash. Source number three. It's a Medrash. Vayasem Mosal Mizbeach, Einei Avram Beinei Yitzchak. Avram looks at Yitzchak. There's no depersonalization, no objectification. It's not some trance. He's looking straight into his son's eyes. Then Yitzchak b'shmei Shemayim. Yitzchak looking to Shemayim. V'hoi demos menashros v'noflos me'enei Avram. Avram's tearing and crying and bawling. This is a flattering image of Avram. HaKadosh Baruch Hu demands a mitzvah. You're changing history. Millions of people throughout thousands of centuries have davened on Rosh Hashanah based on this event and have been scared. And you're crying? You should be thrilled. Should be leaping for joy. You're a history maker. How could you cry? The answer is, how could you not cry? How could you not cry? God forbid to flinch. But God forbid not to cry. So here's a real human being with that humanity under threat, challenged. And again, world of decision, practically, pick up that knife. You make that decision. Remember a couple of years ago, there was a picture on the internet that went viral about the chassid on the plane who was a kohen with a bag on his head. Remember the man in the bag? Yeah. As he was a kohen, he didn't want to fly over a cemetery. So the internet is really good for people who are sarcastic and want to poke fun at others. And that's the Facebook culture. We'll talk about that other times. It's a real challenge to Facebook and not biblical tolerance. Those are the obvious ones. The real challenges are the subtle cultural impulses that creep into your system. An important rule, I use that rule, but you got to know the dangers of that internet territory. So I always like to kick back against all the naysayers and sarcasm. So I put out a share, recorded a share. Every Jew has their bag moment. Got like 2,000 hits. Why is some rabbi defending the chassid? Okay, don't get on a plane if you're a kohen and force yourself to put a garbage bag on your head. That's lunacy. But every Jew faces that moment where you butt up in a situation where it's either convenience and politeness and winning people's applause and doing what's expected, the social norms, or strict adherence to halacha. And when you butt up against that point, you try to caress the two and you try to reconcile the two and you try to find the solutions, but you're always going to be in an airport and just got to get up. And even an airport, I always try to make sure I don't daven on a plane. It's rude to daven on a plane, right? I always make sure I get up early, minyan, airport, whatever. But planes are delayed. You're on the tarmac for 4 hours. My mincha is about to relapse. So you have no choice. You don't stand up. You sit in your seat and you're done. You have no choice. The mitzvah, possibly. Whatever, that's it. Every Jew, that's what orthodoxy is. Halacha comes first. Halacha is primary. You don't bend halacha for convenience. You don't bend halacha for societal norms. Halacha has enough innate flexibility to be bent within the system. But it has to be halachic. Everything's in the halachic system. So here's Avram Avinu, maintaining his humanity, crying, looking at his child as a son, responding as a father. This is a human saga. This is not the suppression of human beings. This is the ennobling of human beings who suppress their decisions but don't suppress their instincts. Another Medrash of Amital would quote us, source number 3, Amalei Yitzchak Abba, Maher v'yaseh ritzon yotzucha v'sorfeini yafeh. Listen to this, Abba, do it quickly. Burn me well. The Efer sholi homech ne'imo. And bring my ashes to mommy. The tanicheu. And put on the side, the kolzman shiter eoimi. And every time Nima looks at them, tamar zer b'ni sheshachto aviv. We serve the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Worried about, again, for us it seems vulgar and crap, but that's what she's worried about. He's worried about how his mother's going to receive the news. Or if you look at the Medrash on the back, it's not digitized, but that little picture on the back. Amar lo Yitzchak, line number 2. Abba, al tisyare. Yitzchak is calming Avram down. Yitzchak is looking at Avram. Avram, Abba, don't be afraid. I'm here with you. Yiratzam, l'fnei ha-makom, she'iskabel ha-ratzam. Kofteni yafa, tie me up well so I don't disrupt it. Line 4, when you go to see Sarah, when you go to see mommy, al tomar lo pitam, don't break the news to her quickly. Make sure she's sitting. I don't want her to inflict any harm. Shalotach bolatzma, I don't want her to do anything rash. Imaha gag tiamedes, if mommy's on the roof, don't tell her, not a good place to tell her. Imala be'er, if she's near a body of water, don't tell her. Shema ki tatulatzma. Look at this. All Yitzchak could care about is how his mother's going to receive the news. Not just Avram was a human being, rather than a robot, or divested of humanity, Yitzchak. And probably, the most stunning statement of Amital taught us, every Tanis, we add brachos. Real Tanis Sibor, anyone know how many brachos we add? Shmon Esrei becomes, 18 becomes, 24. We add 6 brachos, and we cite previous tefillos which were accepted, and we ask that Hashem accept those tefillos just like He accepted our tefillos in the past, because so much of tefillah is emuna that Hashem has listened in the past, He'll listen to us. That's why we invoke precedence of tefillah. We remember Avram, accept our tefillah the same way you accepted Avram. Accept our tefillah the same way you accepted the Yamsuf. Accept our tefillah, we insert into Shmon Esrei and we end with new brachos. So we've got 24 brachos on a real Tanis Sibur. We don't have real Tanis Siburs today. So we just simulate that in the end of Slichos, Mishana Avram Avinu Bahar Moriah, Hu Yaneinu. Mishana Li Yitzchak Beno Kishin Ekar Agabehem Zbeach, Hu Yaneinu. Mishana Li Yaakov Beveisel, Hu Yaneinu. Mishana Li Yosef Beveis Hasurim, Hu Yaneinu. So we don't insert new brachos, but we approximate that experience. But what's the first one? You can see I quoted the Mishnah in Tainus. Source number 3, paragraph Talmud Bavli, Tainus Tesvav. Al Harishana Omer, line 3. Mishana Asavim Avinu Bahar Moriah Hu Yanes. Just like you answered Avram's tefillah on Har Moriah, you should answer our tefillah. Wait a second. Avram davens on Har Moriah? What's he davening for? He's a shochet. He's not a shlich tzibur. Who's he davening to? What's he davening for? There's no record of this in the Torah, of Avraham davening. And yet, it's part of our Shmon Esrei. Mishana Avraham Avinu Bahar Moriah Hu Yaneinu Baruch Ata Hashem Gaal Yisrael. We cite a bracha. Say Hashem's name. So the simple pshat, which is the Medrash, is the Gemara in Yishalmi, that Avraham davens just like I showed such heroism and I suppressed the love for my son and I dedicated my son to you. Anytime the Jewish people anger you, suppress your anger. Avram Davins and my heroism and Har Moriah should endure and should rescue Jews from lesser fates. But if you look carefully at the Medrash I quoted before, there's a whole different tefillah. Avram Davins. Source 3, the third section of Source 3, Yalkut Shimoni. He's crying. Line 3, Be'osasha. He's crying. He's at Har Moriah. Par piv bevechiah. He starts screaming. Vega giyai gotidol. He shrieks. V'ayu'enam mirofifos. And his eyes are fluttering. V'tzofos l'shlina. He looks at the mountains and he says, Shira malos. Esayinai eleharim. I'm looking at the mountains. May I in Yavo Esri, help me! Avram, the Akedah, is davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rescind the Gzera. Yavo Ezri, Ezri mi Yom Hashem. Did you imagine that? His hand is performing the act, but he's davening, please, please, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, withdraw the Gzera. Please, Esayin Ayele Harim. And the fact that we cite this as a precedent for davening makes it sound as if the Akedah would have been canceled based on Avram's tefillah, even if Hashem didn't decide to cancel him anyway. Because otherwise the tefillah is just a ghost tefillah. It's a fake. Avram's tefillah would have canceled the Akedah, but Hashem hadn't decided anyway to cancel for us, because Hashem wanted to demonstrate, and I won't be the sacrifice, I have to bring someone to the brain, to show that's not right. Because this becomes a template, exemplar to you. Just like you answered Avram's tefillah, answer my tefillah. Do you believe that? I can't accept anything less. How could you smile? How could you depersonalize? How could you empty yourself of human emotions? How could you not cry? How could you not daven to the last possible moment? Practically, you serve. But you serve as a human being. It's exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants at Har Moriah. Love, compassion, pity, desperation, and all that rolled up into a ball and suppressed to fulfill the divine will. If Hashem expects it, and in this moment, he expected Avram to be prepared and then to demonstrate that's not what I want. Al tishlach yad chalanar, al tasla mahuma. I don't want blood. I don't want sacrifice. I want life. And I have to drag you to the brink to prove that. You can just imagine the scene, Rosh Hashanah, 700 people, and Avram Tal telling us how we should come in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Come like Avram. Come as a human being. Try to be an angel. You tried your whole year. You fell short. You forgot Hashem. You have your chatayim. It's all right. You're a human being. Hashem wants human beings. No shame in being a human being. You want to dream the next year will be closer to being like a malach? Great. You'll rise, you'll soar, you'll change, you'll improve. You'll still be a human being. You'll still have flaws. No shame. That's precisely what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. Okay? So there'll be a lot of talk this year about that because it's a very, very complex issue. But it's a very powerful issue. And it's important for the following reasons. Number one, because if you try to create your Avodas Hashem solely as a malach, inevitably, there'll be bifurcation. Because you're not always a malach. You're a malach when you're in the base medrash. You're a malach when you... But then you eat, and you drink, and you fail, and you fall, and you have life, and you're... And it's almost as if there's a compartmentalization of times when you feel Avodas Hashem, and times where you're detached from it. You don't feel it because your Avodas Hashem has been translated to terminology that doesn't infuse and suffuse all of your reality. And if we are truly, these sound like cliches, but these are things we strive for, to feel from every minute. And sometimes that firm kind is expressed through ritual and study and mitzvahs, and sometimes it's just expressed by doing the things you do anyway, but do it as part of your Avodas Hashem. I don't think about Hashem all day. When I'm driving, I'm not thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm thinking about not hitting pedestrians. When I'm performing surgery, I'm not thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm thinking about which leg to cut open. And if you're thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu and you're performing surgery, please don't be my surgeon. And when you're understanding a Tosfos, you are not thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You are thinking about the Tosfos. And you're cracking your head and marshaling every fiber, every iota of intellectual energy and resources. But why are you driving carefully? Why are you a responsible doctor? Why are you... Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to. So now go about becoming an excellent, because I'm representing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he's in the background. And I'm thinking about him every moment. So to articulate religion as a complete detachment from this world, a complete withdrawal from your humanity, it creates very, very contained and staccato bursts of religion, but not this religion that captures every moment. And of course, it's also the second danger is if you articulate religion solely in terms that are angelic and extraterrestrial and transcendent. It's not real. It's not who you are as a person. It's not your life. We're grounded here. Everyone has to make that decision and find that. I don't have enough time. I want to read a Rambam with you, but I'll just paraphrase what I wanted to read in the Rambam. Guys, you've been here a week. Feels like a year, right? It's true. This is a corridor. This world is an illusion. This world is transient. I'll never forget Rav Aaron telling us two different approaches to this corridor. The real world is the palace. The real world is eternity. Rav Aaron said, some people feel that since it's a corridor, they should ignore it entirely or get by with the bare minimum. Why should you? Why should you invest in anything in this world? It's all passing. Why shouldn't you? You have to breathe, you have to eat, you have to live. Essentially, spend every minute engaged in the affairs of the palace. Rav Aaron says, some people, and I count myself amongst them, he's talking to his own community, feel that although it's a corridor, we should renovate it so that those who follow in our wake will have easier passage. Sounds like Rav Aaron. It's a corridor, but other people are passing through the corridor. Other people are living in the corridor. And there are needs of the corridor. So we invest in the corridor. Don't lose that sense that it's a corridor. And sometimes you forget that. Sometimes you just get so, this is a good month to remind yourself. We're not monks in a monastery. We don't run away from this world. But we have that proportion. It's all good. It's the proportion. It's the emotional bondage. Sports is good and movies are good. And they're all fine. But the investment of time, and more significantly, the investment of emotion, the submission of will and of identity, that has to change. No one's going to drag you away from them. It's a different outlook and a different perspective. Tower above them. Don't submit to them. It's the corridor. It's small. I'm large. It's time. I'm eternal. It's passing. I last. Things that matter, not things that just pass through my field of vision. And it's really that challenge to transcend who you are and find that other place and other space and live in heaven. But realize you're placed in this earth. And Torah was given to human beings. And at a real level, if Torah is meant to be authentic to you and honest and genuine, not professed and formulaic, and it's hard. I mean, just take, for example, in a gross, gross generalization or oversimplification, but that's just an easy way to highlight things in bold relief. To a degree, the yeshiva world, which has succeeded so phenomenally in producing a prodigious Torah culture, unprecedented. It's to a degree because they step a little bit away from that interaction with who they are as humans. There's a uniform that people don't wear, let's say, on a normal basis, and with a different world and a different language and yeshiva speak. And they've created an insular world that strives for perfection, ignorant and disinterested in affecting the world. They're not disinterested. It's a long-term value. They say they're doing more for the state of Israel and for human redemption than you are. And they'd be right. Because why should I try to redeem our world through human faculty when I can just learn so much Torah and invite Hashem's intervention and let him do it for me? And it's to argue that claim. It's just a different position. Am I to argue that claim? How many missiles have been shot at Israel over the last 20 years? How many have hit? You got to believe it's something else other than the Iron Dome. So we take one approach, and we have to try to parse our resources and distribute them both in eternity and in transience, both in divine reliance and in personal effort and initiative. And they take a harsher stance, more extreme stance. But for us, you have to be sure. I feel like we, on the one hand, we lose so much sight of that other place. We live in a world that's so rational and concrete and sensory and empirical, and we define religion that way. If there's one statement of mine you take from me this week, it's like religion really is transcendent. It's a thrust into a different realm and a relationship with the other. And you can't judge it on the terms that you judge your regular life. What relevance does Masechet Shabbos have to my life? That's a flawed question. Because Torah has internal relevance. Its relevance doesn't have to stem from attaching it and affixing it and comparing it to affairs of the day and politics and celebrity and morality. It doesn't. It's Hashem's will. And Hashem's will has inherent relevance beyond any relevance. Because everything you try to justify its relevance by in faith. So it's a flawed equation. Oh, it's relevant because now I can better understand moral prerogative. I can better understand politics. Better. What does that even mean? This world is so how do you try to define relevance with something that passes? Say, you know, you were one night in a hotel, so all of a sudden you're going to refurbish the room and buy furniture and stick it in the hotel? You're passing through. You're passing through. So that doesn't dictate your identity, your reality. You pass through. So the bed is a little uncomfortable. So you wake up in the morning, you check out. But on the other hand, we feel like Hashem created us in this world and made us as human beings and vested within us all this virtue and nobility as human beings, and that's a world we can't really escape from. It's a very powerful combination to look at those two people. Don't get me wrong, Rav Aaron was a great human being and will share his humanity with you. And Rav Amital knew about other worlds. But somehow to us, that were the two pistons that made this engine drive. I felt like Rav Aaron challenged us beyond our wildest dreams. Whatever you guys are going through, it's nothing. It's a walk in the park, trust me. I'm telling you, wait. However crushed you feel, we were crushed to smithereens. Because we sat there looking at Rav Aaron, which just couldn't make sense of it. At least you can make sense. You trust me when I tell you that if you were to spend the next 10 years in yeshiva, you'd be the shared yud guy next to you. Okay, you make whatever choice you make, but you're capable. I say, you know what, he's probably right. I can trust the Beit Darug, and then I'm not less intelligent than he is. He made a decision, I made a different decision. Or will make it. In your wildest dreams, where did this person come from? How did he become that person? It was mind-blowing. It took us out of our sanity. And Rav Amital would always ground us and make sure. It's all right. Best question I received, I was talking about Rav Aaron in high school. I can say which one, a few months ago. And then I answered on his yard sign, and someone asked me a question. I gave him the form over the questions, and one of the boys said, Rebbe, did you ever feel frustrated or dispirited because you couldn't reach Rav Aaron's standard? That was a complicated answer I gave him, but my one-word answer was, no, we had Rav Amital. And he was just such a loving, caring, calming. To this day, when I go to Rav Aaron's kever, I have a hard time approaching it. I still stand at a distance. I have a very hard time getting it. When I go to Rav Amital's kever, I feel like he's embracing me. I feel like he's drawing me in. He wants me to come close. I hear him calling, come close to my kever. Touch my kever. Be on my kever. That's a very powerful combination. I hope that throughout these sessions, that this year we'll be able to give you each of them. We're not going to tell stories. It's not our purpose. We want to give you bold-faced topics, not just stories of Rav Aaron. So tonight is a start with the limited time we had available, humanity within religion. We'll come back to this.